Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Steve Zwenke. With Memorial Day still fresh in our minds, Cinema Falls presents the remarkable story of a Minnesota man who served our country during World War II and spent time as a POW at a Nazi camp after being shot down over France. Stalag Luft III, One Man's Story, focuses on Charles Worley, who was imprisoned at Stalag Luft III, the location of the storied Great Escape. Interestingly, the documentary is directed and produced by Louise Worley, Charles's niece. She'll be in Sioux Falls Wednesday for a question-answer session when Cinema Falls screens Stalag Luft III at the West Mall 7 beginning at 6:30. Louise Worley is the founder of Worley Gig Productions in Minnesota, and we welcome her right now to In the Moment. Louise, so great to have you joining us today.
Well, thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me. It's really fun to be talking to your audience today.
Yeah, I had the chance to watch the film yesterday, and I have to begin by saying that having watched it, I can't imagine anybody not falling in love with your Uncle Charles.
Oh, well, I would have to agree with you there. He's a pretty special guy, and hence why I wanted to tell the story.
Yeah, and you were telling me that also that the crew of the film called him Uncle Charles, and they had the very same feelings about him.
Oh, they did. I remember one time, Steve, I'll tell you a brief story. Everybody started calling him Uncle Charles, and we had a sound guy on one of our shoots. When we were done that day, he left to go be on a date with his wife. It was their first time out after having a baby, a newborn. And Uncle Charles pulls out $40, two $20 bills, and says, "Here you go. You know, a bottle of wine and some money for the babysitter." And that's just how he was. He was amazing.
I was without words when I ended up when I finished watching the film yesterday. I was just without words because I enjoyed it so much. I was just impressed with all aspects of it. Let's kind of go back a little bit here. Briefly, could you tell us about Charles' life up to the time that he went to West Point Prep at Fort Snelling in Minnesota?
Well, he was my dad's identical twin brother. They were the last of six children born. He grew up in Pine City, Minnesota, which is about an hour and a half north of Minneapolis. And they grew up in a town that was really a lovely little town. And his father was an immigrant, and Uncle Charles, actually, to clarify, he did not get accepted to West Point. It was the person who did the best at Fort Snelling was selected for the West Point position. He did not get that. But during the Depression, you know, times were rough, and he was working summers in Montana at Glacier Park, and he heard about a school that paid you. And so he and his friend went down to Fort Snelling, signed up, and there you go. He was in the Fort Snelling serving as a private, and not serving, but training as a private. And that's how his initial career began.
Sure.
In the military.
Yeah, and he did not want to become an infantryman, so he got interested in becoming a pilot, and he did well, but he ended up being a bombardier. How did that happen?
Well, Uncle Charles, this will be revealed in the film for the audience that comes to see it, but he was a little older when he entered in the Air Corps, and so he did have an opportunity to go into the Air Corps. He tested, he got in, he was training as a pilot, but because he was a little older, he was a little more cautious. So on his landings, when he was getting his final checkout, he was just too cautious, and they said that. And so they said, we're going to send you to bombardier training. And, of course, you can only imagine after all that training and time and excitement, he was a little down, but he switched gears. And being a bombardier was actually the best place for him as a result of that experience.
Yeah, caution,
so, yeah,
caution and being a pilot of a warbird don't necessarily go hand in hand, do they?
Not necessarily, no. But he had the technical aptitude to be a bombardier. So he took to it very quickly.
Yeah. It's a very interesting and a tough position. A B-17 Flying Fortress is a crew of 10 men. Where exactly on the plane would Charles have been situated as a bombardier?
Well, he was in the front nose cone.
Wow.
So that was a plexiglass nose cone. So you're fully exposed. And it's a very, every part of the plane is obviously going to be a vulnerable spot to be in. But mm-hmm. he was in an especially vulnerable spot.
Yeah, the B-17s. The B-17 is one of the greatest plane that I believe was ever constructed for our Air Corps. They took a beating. They absolutely took a beating, and they would come home just riddled with damage a lot of times. I was really impressed, and I was kind of surprised too. The footage in your film looks so authentic, but I was surprised to hear that so much of it was green screen.
Well, I'll tell you, we have a great community here in Minneapolis in post-production and in production, and I worked with some very talented visual effects artists. Now, I will say that we did have archival footage that was 16 millimeter that we transferred, but our colorist did an amazing job matching the archival footage with our reenactment footage.
Mm-hmm.
So the air battle sequence where we see the guys in the B-17 was all shot with green screen. And what that allows, for anyone in the audience that doesn't really know what that is, what that allows us to do is to create the background. So out those windows, when you see the bombs going off and planes whizzing by, that was all created. And I'm really proud of that. And we have a great team here, and I was just really happy that that turned out so well.
It really did. Before we talk about some missions, your Uncle Charles Wehrli, again, the subject of Louise Wehrli's film, Stalag Luft 3, One Man's Story. Again, you can see it tomorrow night at West Mall 7, presented by Cinema Falls. He had so many interesting stories. He got to know Clark Gable on more than one occasion. He met him early in life and then again on, I believe, at Polbrook, England. Is that right?
That's correct. Actually, he met him on the way over. He flew over with his bomb group.
Mm-hmm.
Clark had lost his... I'm talking about him like I know him. Yes, Clark, our old friend. No, but, Mr. Gable actually lost his wife, tragically. And I think her name was Carol Lombard. And anyway, he wanted to take advantage of going over to Europe to shoot some films for navigators, bombardiers, and tail gunners. So he did that. And Uncle Charles, yes, had met him earlier in his life at Glacier Park.
Yeah. And Clark Gable was actually asked to produce a recruiting film for bombardiers and other aspects of flight.
That's right.
Yeah.
He did. So they, you know, and it's interesting because Uncle Charles's career actually in photography started at Glacier Park.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, when he got out of the war, and there's a story about a camera in mm-hmm. the film as well, he started the first film company here in Minneapolis, Empire Photo Sound. So he learned how to be a photographer, and then he got into film as well and developing. And so it was a pretty great experience being able to work on this project with an uncle who really understood what we were trying to do.
Yeah, he
had telling his story.
He had an incredible life, and unfortunately, of it, a couple of years of it were spent in a POW camp. If we get to a point where we're giving too much away, just let me know. But he was flying missions out of Polbrook, England, and was shot down over France, which was under Nazi control at the time. Was his plane first hit by flak, or was it first hit by bullets from a fighter plane?
Flak.
Flak first.
Yep, it was flak first. That's right.
And then the fighters
came. Everything was happening. Yes, then the fighters came. But I will tell you that, and he admits this, I mean, when you're young and you're over there and you're there to fight for your country, I mean, they went up on these heavy bombers and they did formation flying, which is they flew in a formation that they thought would keep them safe, or the government thought it would keep them safe. Well, it didn't. It was the flak that really interfered with, getting them damaged and falling out of the sky, as well as the fighter planes that came in, the German fighters. So whenever these guys went up on, imagine this, going up on a mission, and you have a 50-50 chance of coming back.
Yeah.
You're either going to be shot down or killed or taken prisoner.
On the particular day that his B-17 was shot down, it sounds like the odds were really against it, because they always flew during daytime, which makes you more visible. But it sounds as also like they were without escort that day. Is that the truth?
Well, it wasn't just that day, Steve. They didn't have fighter cover then.
Wow.
There wasn't any. He was in early, so they didn't have any fighter cover, and that's why it was the 50-50 chance of getting killed or shot down. Yes. So, yeah, I mean, that's just remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah.
To think that they were so visible. And right. And when he got into Stalag Luft 3 and he talked to the RAF guys that he roomed with first, they couldn't get over the fact that he flew during the day. And he said, well, I can't believe you fly at night. And so they commiserated on each other's, you know, daytime or nighttime flying.
Yeah, that's interesting, too, because when he first went to Stalag Luft 3, everybody in his quarters were from other countries. There were British, there were Canadians, there were Australians, I believe. And it turned out to be kind of a good thing for him because he learned quite a bit.
He sure did. He was immersed into a group that was involved with the tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
And doing work for them that people can learn about when they go see the film. But it was every step of the way, I must say, and I don't know if you experienced this, Steve, watching it, but it seemed like things happened. I don't know. He just landed on his feet, or a situation would occur that was like, oh my gosh, how did that happen? And I have heard these stories from other veterans who flew in World War II. And that's what I want to make this mention. The reason I wanted to make this film was so that Uncle Charles' story could represent a more universal story. Even though it's unique to him, I didn't want this to be a tribute film. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be able to kind of help people understand what these guys went through. And he does talk about his, you know, his crew, his bunkmates, his fellow POWs. And that was really the purpose of this. So I really think it speaks to a lot of veterans how certain things happened, and you think, how the heck did that happen?
No,
did they survive that?
Yeah, I got that exact same feeling. And one of the that he was always able to land on his feet, that things seem to happen for a reason. And I go back to one incident, and that's when he is parachuting after jumping from the plane. And
yeah, but you can't give that away, Steve.
He said the Lord's Prayer. He said the Lord's Prayer. And I wanted to make known that it was religion really drove him, too. And I think that's part of it.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. I'm sorry I cut you off.
I wasn't going to.
Okay, good. Now, see, people are getting really
We're not
intrigued.
Giving away the big happens. Parts.
Right. But, you know, what's interesting about that comment is that even though he was raised, they went to church every Sunday and there was, you know, Sunday school, and his mother was a very faithful woman. He really, it was part of just a natural thing to want to say the Lord's Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
But I was looking for, he wasn't particularly religious, though. His kind of transformation didn't happen until after the war, where he was hit by a thunderbolt, really, and a very personal spiritual life. But up until that point, you know, he went to church, he believed in God, yes. His mother was praying for him and his two brothers who were also in the war, including my dad, mm-hmm. who was his identical twin. So there was a lot of prayer going on, but a lot of mothers were praying for their sons.
Yeah. His descriptions of life at Stalag Luft 13 are so interesting. He talks about the code work of the POWs, the tunnels, of course. You know, there's a lot of things in that film that are things you would see on Hogan's Heroes.
Oh, it's so funny you would say Hogan's Heroes. Well, first of all, I want to clarify, and people do this all the time, Steve. It's Stalag Luft 3. You said Stalag 13.
Sorry.
That's okay. No, there's a lot of different Stalags, though. I didn't even know that until I got into my research. That there were several different Stalags. That theirs happened to be an officer's camp. So they were treated better than most. The Germans respected airmen. And I think that's why they had it a little better than any other camp in terms of, you know, it was pretty bad generally anyway, but they had it a little better. But whenever anyone would mention the Great Escape movie with Steve McQueen or Hogan's Heroes, he would say, I never liked Hogan's Heroes. But he thought that the Great Escape was pretty good. He goes, you know, they made it look pretty cleaned up, but he liked that movie. So he did. I think it was the humor around Hogan's Heroes, even though they have humor within the camp, too.
Yeah, they did.
And he talked about that. Yeah.
And they did some of the things you would see them do. I mean, they did plays, they sang. Just really interesting that they had the freedom within a camp like that to do some things. Things got worse, though, because he ended up at Stalag 7A in Moosburg, and that camp was basically a 180 turn, wasn't it?
It sure was. And he actually, in the film, says that there were 100,000 people in that camp. It was like a concentration camp.
Yeah.
But I found out later that there were 130,000 men, and it was horrible. It's just beyond what you could ever imagine. It was really, really bad.
He talks about fleas, unmanaged waste, human waste, and just the number of people. His comment was that the only thing that saved them was their youth.
Yes, and I believe that's true. I believe that they were able to support each other, and when you have hope, you just have to. I think I've never been in a dire situation like that, but what I have learned from him is that hope is what kept them going and each other.
We have just about 30 seconds, Louise. Charles passed away in 2015. When did you film the scenes with Charles?
They stretched from 2010 until about 2014. So we spanned almost 100 years of his life. He died when he was 98, almost 99. Mm-hmm.
An excellent documentary. The film Stalag Luft 3, One Man's Story, will be shown at the West Mall 7 tomorrow night, Wednesday, with the film at 6:30. Tickets are $11.50 in advance. You may want to purchase one before they sell out. They are $13.50 at the door. Post-film Q&A with our guest Louise Worley will take place again tomorrow night at West Mall 7. Louise, it's been a pleasure. I thank you for making the film. I sure enjoyed it. And welcome to South Dakota tomorrow.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks so much for this wonderful interview. I really enjoyed it.